Off the ball. This is News Talk.
Now, you're welcome back to studio. In the next hour, we'll have Stephen Elliott talking about Republic of Ireland, if you can bear it. In the meantime, we're talking about a new book on the seventh day, 30 years of great sports writing from the Sunday Independent, edited by John Green, who's here in studio. Hello, John.
Hi, Joe.
Thank you for coming in. And Paul Kimmage, of course, with the Sunday Independent, two features across the book. Thanks for coming in. So you say, John, when you're introducing the book, it's not an anthology of memorable moments in Irish sport over the last 30 years, although some are there, nor is it intended as a chronicle of those years. It's intended to cast a light on the world of Irish sport in all its forms, which is what the Sunday Independent strives to do every week. These are my choices based on what I think the paper has brought to the sporting landscape over three decades. That's a neat summary of what this is?
Yeah, I couldn't have put it any better myself. Well, I did.
You did put it that way. Yes, yeah.
But, yeah, it was really important that this not fall into a trap of being about the greatest football team of all time, the greatest rugby team of all time, or great moments in soccer. But some of them are there. Mm-hmm. Some are treated in different ways. Because if I took that approach, then, you know, pieces like David Walsh's interview with a guy from Leitrim called Seamus O'Rourke about his experience of going to the 1994 Connacht final, which Leitrim won, wouldn't be there. Or the story of Eamon Sweeney spending 5 days in Longford, going over and back between two rural parishes in the build-up to them playing in a county final, probably wouldn't be there. Mm. So it was very important that I got the right balance, and that, you know, there's a piece about Catriona McKernan in it, for example,
but
there's none directly about Sonia.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you were doing the best of, you'd probably have put Sonia in. So it was really important that I let the writing speak to me a little bit too, and that I tried to be as wide in the approach that I took. I'm not pretending, or we're not pretending, that this is the best pieces that have been published over 30 years. It's a selection.
This has nothing to do with me, so you take full responsibility for what you're pretending.
By we, I meant the Royal We, which is the Sunday Independent and Mercer. It is a selection of what the Sunday Independent, I think, has brought to journalism and to sports writing over the last 30 years.
And how many of these, when you set out to do this, jumped to your mind immediately and then you went back and read them and they got the tick? And how many?
Well, there were two pieces. I said we launched the book the other night, and I went into this with an open mind. And of course, when anybody says that they will go into something with an open mind, they're immediately telling a lie, because it's impossible not to bring your own biases into it. So the two particular biases that I brought to this were, the first was that I had two pieces in my head that were absolutely going to be, even though I hadn't read them in years, there were two pieces that were going to be in it, which predated me, but which I remembered. And then I was going to make sure that there was, you know, that the Longfords and Leitrims of this world wouldn't be ignored. You know, the smaller counties, sure, or the smaller sports even. The two pieces that were in my head were Paul's interview at Roy Keane in Saipan, which was a very important piece, you know, in Irish sporting journalism. And also Paul's brother Kevin, who worked for the Sunday Independent for many years, did an interview with Paddy O'Shea in 2003, I think, which might have been the end of 2002, was it? And then it was published the first week in January in 2003. In which he made a famous reference to Kerry supporters as being effing animals, but the context of it wasn't how it was then portrayed and the reaction to it. They were two pieces that were in my mind from the start.
Right.
And when I went back to read them as part of the process, that only just copper fastened in my mind. And then on the first run through, the two other pieces that jumped out at me straight away were the two David Walsh pieces, one of which I mentioned, which was Seamus O'Rourke, and then an interview with Aidan O'Brien, which I absolutely loved when I read it.
When he was 25, 26.
The bit that swung it was the very last sentence, when there's a two-year-old kind of pulling at his daddy's legs to show him how to do something, and that two-year-old is Joseph.
Yeah.
And I just thought, that's just an amazing image.
Yeah,
and I couldn't shake it.
Yeah.
And from there, I just started to build and build and build. But I think initially I had 750 pieces in and around, something like that. And then it's down to, I think there's 47 or 48.
48 yeah. Which of your pieces, Paul, would you have included if you could have included one or two?
Well, it's 30 years. So you started in 1988, right?
Started in June 88.
Well, it was kind of interesting because in July of 89, I was riding the Tour de France, and I remember Eamon Dunphy came over to the Tour this year, which was quite rare. I'd never seen Dunphy at a bike race before. And he came to the Tour, and he came on the eve of the fourth Pyrenean stage, or the second Pyrenean stage. And he came to the hotel and he wrote a piece about it. And it was about Roach, because Roach actually had abandoned that day. Or had a really hard day that day. Yeah, he'd gone into it with a good chance. He'd ridden a good Giro d'Italia that year. Got into the Tour, but was having all sorts of squabbles with the team. And Eamon was going to focus on that. But obviously, I'd started now doing a diary at that stage for the Sunday Tribune. Mm. And he'd obviously read that diary, and he was very complimentary to me in the course of the piece he wrote about Stephen. And I was just, I don't know, I actually saw it. I dug it out the other day, because I kept this piece in my wallet for about 4 years. I retired 2 days later. I stopped 2 days later, and I effectively started my career as a sports writer 6 months after that. Mm. But I remember, I found it interesting that Eamon should come almost on the eve of me stopping, and that we would end up in the same paper 4 years later. But some of the best lessons I got from about sports writing were from Eamon, and I noticed the reaction he got. I listened to the pay-per-view, was it 2 weeks ago he ran the piece?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. To that piece he wrote in 1990, and it was almost an awakening. People, well, actually, this is not this loudmouth we watch on TV. This is someone who's an outstanding writer, and I've always said that about Eamon. Absolutely outstanding writer.
Did you learn directly from him, as in he sat down and gave you some thoughts, or just by reading him?
Well, the best advice he gave me was about Sunday newspapers. He said, you know, Paul, the greatest thing you're doing now is that you're starting with a Sunday newspaper, because you only have to go to the well once a week. So you're not doing like the dailies are. Every day they've got to dig and dig and dig.
Yeah.
And in terms of longevity and in terms of your enthusiasm for the craft, that was a big deal. So that was actually the best thing he ever said to me. You only go to the well once a week.
As in, steer clear of dailies?
Well, it's different. It's different. It's different.
No, another way of putting it is you get one shot at it.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. You get one shot at it, and it has to count. It has to matter. Okay, you go to the well once a week, but you're going deep. You're going deep. Mm. That was really great advice. The best training I got was when I went to the Sunday, and I don't think this happens now, John, you can correct me, but when I went to the start of the Sunday Tribune in January of 1990, I'd write these pieces and I'd go in on the Monday, and Vincent Brown would call me in, and there'd be red pen all over the stuff that I'd done, right? And I don't think that happens now, but that's how I learned. I mean, I got a bollocking when I went in there for some of the stuff. And when I look back at it now and I can see it with Jesus. Because when I made that transition, I actually won Sports Writer of the Year before I actually started writing with the paper for those Tribune diaries. I kind of thought I'd invented writing and sports writing. And I started with the Tribune, and straight away I knew that I was actually, you know, not that good. I had a lot to learn. Mm. And I think, you know, that served me better than anything else, really. The fact that I had working with an editor, it was going to bring me, that's not good enough. I don't want that.
What he was teaching me was, and it isn't done as much now, but what he was teaching you now was that you can't be careless with words. You know, that when you're putting a word on a page, that you need to have thought about that word.
Yeah.
And that was something that was brilliant about Dunphy. And, you know, listening to that pay-per-view a couple of weeks ago,
you
could see the thought that went into the words.
Yeah, no,
you know,
it's
and
true.
Why did you use that word? And what were you thinking there? And that was what Vincent used to do, and other great editors would do that as well.
To a degree, but also it was an editorial element of, why didn't you ask him this? And, you know, and that was great training.
Mm. And did you resent it at the time, or did you think?
No, I didn't. I never resented it. And I listened to your pay-per-view earlier, and I guess you're a little bit cross with me for some of the criticisms I made in the paper about your roadshow. You shouldn't accept that as personal, because you'll never learn if you take that as personal. You will never learn. You've got to take it for what it is. You've got to react in the way that you think fit, but you've got to listen, because you're going to walk down that street, Joe, and you're going to find 300 fellas who are going to say, you know, Joe, you're great. And what are you going to learn from that? Nothing. You want to listen to the guy who thinks, you know what, I listened to that. Why didn't you do that? That's how you learn. Don't read the good reviews, read the bad ones. That's how you get better. And from the moment I've gone into this business, I've strived to get better. To today. And it took me a long, long time to do that.
And were there certain things that Brian was hauling you up on? Was there a trend, or is it just lots of different things? Nothing sticks out as such?
Elements of the writing.
Looking in the right places.
In the right places. Asking the right questions. Oh, Jesus Christ. You know, I mean, I can't really take him off that well. But, you know, it was, you know, teaching me that it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular. You know, and he was great at that, Vincent. I mean, Jesus.
I heard a thing being played back last week someplace of him questioning one of the Troika, was it?
That's right.
With a microphone a few years ago.
Yeah.
They tried to shut him up.
And the line of questioning and the way he persisted with it.
He was just a great teacher. I've got a portrait of Vincent over my door in my office, and I don't say I kneel to it every day, but he's up there for a reason.
Right.
John, you're just blown, by the way, so I don't want you to take...
You're in the bathroom, John.
I don't want you to feel left out. But
does Vincent know you have a picture of him in your office?
Vincent wouldn't care.
Well, that's true, actually. Yeah, he couldn't give it to you.
He'd be giving out about that. He wouldn't want that at all.
Grow up, he'd say.
Yeah.
Hey, you mentioned Dunphy. Like, one of the best pieces is Dunphy with George Best.
Yeah, I think I spoke to you casually a few months ago, and I told you about this project that I was working on about Dunphy and about rediscovering him. You know, I just about remember him. I was, you know, just starting out in college and early years of the job of journalism. So I do remember. I did have an institutional memory of Dunphy and what he did in news and sport. But it was only going back into the pieces. And then, you know, I had this stack of stuff, one pile of stuff with Eamons, and then trying to say, OK, how am I going to whittle this down?
Yeah.
But that one just jumped out at me, even more so than the one that we published a couple of weeks ago about Italian 90. That one just stood out at me because, I think you referenced it earlier, you think at the start that we're going to get into a hair-raising afternoon of champagne drinking noise.
I thought I would be very disappointed by this piece.
Yes.
I thought it was going to be, then we drank this, and then we drank that, and then we saw this girl, and it was great.
And that's not what happens at all.
No, it's the opposite. It's very poignant.
I referenced it in the introduction to the piece that the sadness of the piece for me was that, you know, given that we're looking at this 28, what year was that? 1990, was it? So 28 years later, with the benefit of hindsight, the piece is full of hope for him, and ultimately, you know, that was a hope that was he was very fervent about Dunphy, but it was misplaced in the end, and that's the real sadness of it, I think, reading it all these years later.
Yeah, what I didn't realise about Best, and I'd never really seen it written anywhere else, the context is he's just gone on Wogan. It's a very famous appearance in Wogan, and he's been drunk and he hasn't done brilliantly. His father's called him and said, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And Dunphy makes an arrangement to go and see him. He's gone out with a woman called Mary at the time. And the three of them are in the pub. And it's not the hell-raising kind of travails through London that you might expect.
Compton is there as well, by coincidence.
The truth is, George, highly intelligent, always has been. And he talks about how your body withers, your spirit remains alive, redundant, but alive, and if football means as much to you as it did to George Best, the sense of being disabled is painful, cruel, and ever present. And he says, contentment is what George Best will never have again. Booze is an anaesthetic, girls a distraction. And he goes on to talk,
about the Wogan, he compares it to a follow-up appearance with Gay Byrne.
Yeah.
And there's some line about television is for glib men, and George is not a glib man, something like that. And he talks about, and Bess says back to him, words. You know, that there's this sense that George wasn't articulate in terms of speaking.
Yes.
But they have a quiz, and, you know, as you know, you referenced it earlier, he knocks it out of the park. He's just...
So Mary, his girlfriend, brings a copy of Mastermind. Who invented the bouncing bomb? Barnes Wallace. Who succeeded Khrushchev at the Kremlin? Brezhnev. Who shot Lee Harvey Oswald? Jack Ruby. We had great fun for an hour or so. George was incredible. All the answers above are his. Which just kind of stunned me. And it's a brilliant way to do it, to give the answers first, and then you realise Best has got all these answers.
Yeah.
He opened up the book again. Sample questions from the Mensa test. There were 4 questions. He answered 3. He is inarticulate. That is Dunphy's conclusion. He's trapped by his inarticulacy. Yeah. But he can't sleep. He goes to bed at 1. He wakes up in 5. And he is sort of trapped as well in this after-dinner, well, hell, it seems like, frankly. He must trade on his notoriety. Do Wogan, sportsman dinners, recount his dalliances with empty beauty queens. Be George Best as the world understands him. That's what people want. That's what he delivers. And every time he does it, he squanders some self-respect, the kind that really matters. And it's a very slow afternoon in a pub where they have a nice, poignant enough afternoon, and then it's, I'll see you. Yeah.
I met George at a dinner. I think Pat Egan ran a dinner, and I was sitting around the table with him. I'd say probably maybe 5 or 6 years before he died, and he was just a shell. It was just nobody there, nobody home. And he was a hero of mine as a kid, and it was very sad, really. You know, I wouldn't have been aware of that piece now at the time.
He wrote a lot about George Best, and he clearly was loved to George Best, and he knew him, obviously, which helped. But he was so full of concern for him, and that was obvious across. Like, you know, this was a standout piece, but he had written, you know, at least 3 really powerful pieces about Best, and it's very similar to another piece in the book, which about Alex Higgins, and the similarities and the overlaps and the tragedy of their lives comes through.
It's when Higgins is making an appearance as a past champion.
Yeah. And he's getting measured for a suit.
It's onto Louis Copeland and trying to get a suit, and wants to maintain a sense of his reputation. But
it's another lovely piece, and it's full of sadness too. And again, with you look at some of these with hindsight, and you know what way it's gone for them, you know, and there's a certain sadness there, you know.
Yeah. Ewan Roy Keane is a brilliant read still all these years later. Do you agree?
Do I agree? Well, look, I'll take it. I'll take whatever.
You won't get him to
I'll take
that.
Whatever. I haven't spoken to Roy since, which is astonishing.
Wow.
Before the Euros last year, and it's interesting, I think there are some references to that. So that was done, that interview was done, I think, 2 days before he went home. It was just before the blowout.
Yeah.
And it was done on the rest day, and the rest of the team were going off playing golf for the day. And Roy was absolutely spewing about the fact that his teammates were going off playing golf. You know, they're actually going to relax and enjoy this. And it was one of the things about him that made him makes him such a compelling study and a compelling interview. But I remember he was absolutely spewing about this. And then, so when the last time I saw him was down when I interviewed Martin Neal before the Euros, down in Cork in the team hotel, and we were on about round 4 of that interview, and Martin actually says, look, come back after, we're giving a prize, we've had a golf day today, we're giving out some prizes here. And Roy was there, and he'd actually played golf with the lads for the day, and I just thought, Jesus, well, what's going on here? But he would have seen me there, and the next day then, or was the day before, after he'd been really critical of Jeff Hendrick and somebody else, that they played that friendly against, was it Estonia perhaps, one of the funny nations down in Cork?
Cork, yeah.
And he absolutely ripped the arse out of Hendrick and somebody else at a press conference. And then he was going to do some for a few of the Sundays. And we were sitting around these sort of standing around these round tables on Sundays, about 6 of us. And Roy was there, and I was there. He did not look at me. It was almost like, you know, now I would have had a great relationship with him.
Right.
A great relationship with him up until that interview. And, you know.
Why does he hold you in some way responsible?
I don't know whether he thought I should have taken his side. I don't know.
In the piece?
Yeah, well, in the aftermath, I would say.
And whose side did you take?
I was very much on Mick's side, yeah, very much so, yeah.
That'd do it.
And it would do it, yeah, absolutely. And on his teammate side, on the McAteers and the guys who idolised, I mean, they idolised. That was the sadness of it, you know?
But you know what? I read this piece back and I didn't massively like him.
You didn't like Roy?
Not really. I found him fascinating.
Yeah.
But I thought, as a human being, there was just moments in it I didn't like. Like, for instance, one which I looked at and I just thought, to do this publicly to your teammate on the eve of a World Cup is not good, you know? So you're talking about the barbecue with the press.
Yeah.
The great thing about this is everyone remembers this like it's yesterday. So yeah. The barbecue with the press. Yeah, but a lot of them are hypocrites, you know, because you're saying, like, you know, it's good public relations and they want you to sit there and have a barbecue with the guy who 3 or 4 years ago wrote an article encouraging people to boo me at an international match. Am I supposed to enjoy that? I'm supposed to feel comfortable? I've no problem with that. But then it goes down.
Because yeah, I agree. I get that totally.
By Tuesday afternoon, you're in good form, you say to him. Jason says he's spoken to you more in the last couple of days than in the last couple of years. Relations within the team are good. I wouldn't take too much notice of what Jason says. Jason has a big mouth.
Yeah.
Even when he says nice things about you, you say. Even when he says, as he did last week, when you were getting it in the neck from the papers, people remember he didn't show up to Niall Quinn's testimonial game, that people never hear about the Roy Keane that goes to visit sick kids in hospital. Nah. Jason's just being Jason. He's probably hoping I'll find that out.
And what does that tell you about Roy? And it's true to this day. It is true to this day. And it's the reason he has never made it in management and never will make it in management. He cannot deal with people. He actually cannot deal with people. It's a weakness in his character trait, fault he has, and he actually cannot deal with people.
To not think that mightn't affect an important enough player 3, 4, 5, 6 days later at a World Cup to be talking about him publicly like that, I think is a massive misjudgment.
Yeah.
And I came away thinking, God, it's nasty. Maybe Jason is saying this publicly in the hope that you'll find it
out.
Well,
he wasn't.
But even if he was...
Yeah. He was totally genuine about his affection for Roy. Oh, he was.
Even if he was doing it hoping Roy would find it out, he's doing it to try and build relations.
And
that's a worst case interpretation.
They all idolized him. That was the tragedy of it, if you can use that word in sport at all. I don't think you can. But anyway, that was what happened down there. All of those guys, they idolized him. And they didn't want much from him. But they didn't want him going in the papers and in that interview and in the one he done with Tom Humphreys ripping the arse out of them. Now, that wasn't right.
Did you come away from that thinking?
I did.
That's a bit.
I came away saying, "Oh my God, this is going to cause an absolute
shitstorm."
Yeah,
yeah.
I was in no doubt whatsoever that it would cause a shitstorm, and it did. So I knew, and I had this conversation with Tom Humphreys because, so I'd set the interview up. Tom Humphreys was working for the Irish Times and he had gone to Roy and arranged to see him after I'd come out I'd arranged the room in the hotel where I was going to interview Roy, and Tom then had said, listen, I need, so he'd come in. I literally put the ball on the tee because I'd spent about an hour and 10 minutes with him, and Tom came in after that. So the ball was on the tee. All he had to do was hit it off the tee in terms of Roy being worked up.
Yeah.
But I remember walking back to our hotel with Tom after we'd done that interview, right? And our reactions were completely different. I just thought, oh Jesus, this is going to cause, this is mega.
Yeah.
And Tom wasn't of that opinion.
I remember, I knew that was the passage you were coming for, and it's a couple of months since I've read that back. When I read it at the time, and when you take it in tandem with the piece that opens the book, which is Inside the Team That Mick Built, which was published over 2 weeks in the paper prior to that, after the Holland game in at the end of 2001, where the absolute dominant figure in that, it's 17,500 words, and the absolute dominant figure in that piece is Roy Keane.
Yeah.
And you didn't speak to him.
He was the only one who you didn't speak to.
They are all obsessed with
him. He looms large,
That particular passage, and I get what you're saying, and you were in the room, so you saw what happened. There was an element of that, and I've always thought this about him. There's an element of awkwardness there at not being able to take a compliment. And you've paid him a compliment, and his first thing to do is say, I don't pass any heel on Jason, because he can't take the compliment.
For me, that's too much of a free pass. Make a quip about yourself. I'm a real mother.
And then he doubles down on it after, and that's when the real problem is, because you asked him the next question. And if you know what I'm saying? If it had just been... don't pass much remarks on Jason, and then you moved on to the next question that you had, that's all it would have been.
I wouldn't take too much notice of what Jason says. Jason has a big mouth. No.
I'm not giving him a free pass, but I think I've been watching him for a long, long time, and there's always been this element of awkwardness around any attempt.
No, I get that. What about Jason?
Suggest something positive about him.
What about you saying, I really don't do much, Jason being,
But then that's Roy being Roy.
Yeah, but that's a free pass in my book. Roy being Roy, that's not good enough.
Well,
you're an adult.
McAteer's affection for him is clear, because if you've read the first piece...
What was even more unusual was that, I remember, and again, in terms of the way things have changed now and the access we had, we were on the flight. I was on the flight with the boys.
Yeah.
We flew over through Amsterdam, connected to Amsterdam, connected again in Tokyo. So I saw it all. And I remember going off, walking off to the team hotel the next morning, because the hotels are about 300 yards, 400 yards apart. And I remember walking over to the team hotel the next morning and going into the dining area. And Roy was sitting around having breakfast with, I think, Jason, and there was about four of them. And they were having a great time. Mm. I just thought, Jason, isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
So then you get that. And then you know, a few days later, this interview, and he's absolutely ripping the arse.
That's why if I was McAteer, I'd be thinking, what is going on? Yeah.
Well, how long have we been asking that about Roy? What is going on? I mean, that is the essential Roy, you know.
He jumped out there.
This short conversation just shows there's no one answer.
No.
Yeah. You can't condense 17. I didn't realize it was 17,000 words. The first
17
two.
17 and a half.
Yeah, the first two chapters, the team that Mick built, parts one and two. Do you know what comes across? So this is November 2001. This is post the Holland thing. What comes across is they're a good bunch of lads, actually.
Great lads.
The 01
absolutely
match.
Great.
We've sort of seen snippets of them, like the Kilbans and the Kenny Cunninghams and different fellas. And it comes across here. McAteer. I think I was really on McAteer's side when I got to the Roy piece, because in this part, I love him.
Yeah. No, you couldn't but love Jason. But I actually don't know whether there were any that I didn't like on that team. They were a great bunch. But again, you see, and I mentioned about the way things have changed now. I mean, who's to say this bunch aren't a great bunch? We just don't know them. We don't get access to them. All we get is they're browned off walking out after the game, and we get them for a few minutes walking through the mix zone. And it's a real pity, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
There's lovely bits in that. Like, I didn't realise Damien Duff had gone out with McAteer the week before the Holland match on the tear. They deserved it, you know, just the tension coming up. And Duff promises his younger brother, Jamie, look, I'm sorry, I know we're going to watch Match of the Day. I promise you next week, if we win, lose or draw, I will stay in with you and we'll eat chocolate and have a great time. Mm. Now, you're within your rights there as a big brother to say, we've just beaten Holland, but I'm obviously going to end the
tear. You can take a rain check
on that one. I'll hang out with you all day tomorrow. In fairness to Duff, he goes home with his family that night and hangs out with his brother.
Yeah.
Something beautiful about that.
Yeah.
The thing that screams out isn't the access, the thing that screams out about that piece. I mean, I asked you after when I told you about it, and you said it took you a month.
Took
a month to do.
Yeah, I was wondering, so you just spoke to them, because there's a lot of like conversations in dressing rooms that are recounted and private stuff that you've just got out of them, memories. That
so I went to all of them after it.
Yeah.
Obviously there was the game.
Yeah.
And that was going to be the central point of it. But I then arranged interviews to go and see all of them in different places, wherever they were. I mean, the three Leeds boys were all together.
Yeah. And they were all just happy to cooperate, were they?
Yeah.
See, that wouldn't.
Well, point about it is that, okay, so they knew, and again, this struck me the other day. I'm trying to think what the context of it was. But again, traveling with the team, they know your face, they see you around, they read the stuff you're doing, they know it's a bit different, they make you know what I mean? There's a trust that's built up there, and a relationship that's built up over a long time because of. Essentially what it is the investment that the paper is making in you as a journalist to allow you to go and do that. And that would never have happened without an editor, Eoin O'Sullivan, a sports editor at the time, who said, Paul Roy, go and do what you need to do. And, you know, it may be on the paper for a couple of weeks, but it's a great project, go and do it. And if you don't get that back, and you can't do that, and that's where I've been really fortunate in my time with the newspaper, to have that backing from Eoin, and now from John, to do the same team. Because I know that that isn't across the board for a lot of reasons, and that some of the guys out there would very much love that back, and then they don't get it. I'm very fortunate, and I always have been.
I found myself kind of reading, it was about 2 a.m, and I was like, I've read enough now.
Sorry, Joe, can I make one small, this is kind of important point. So you asked me about Roy and taking sides. So something really interesting happened. I don't know whether I was supposed to bring this up. I'm probably going into trouble now. So something really interesting happened when that Roy Keane interview was published.
By which stage he had gone home?
He'd gone home.
Yeah.
And it was just absolutely Armageddon at this stage. It was massive. So we published the interview. And one of our editors pulled a quote out of the piece, right? And splashed it across the masthead of the newspaper.
It's about tattoos.
And so I'd asked him in the course of the interview, and again, this is another insight into him. I'd noticed he had the names of his kids on his arm.
Yeah.
I said, well, that's, what about your wife? She's not there. And he says, well, my kids will always be my kids. My wife may not always be my wife. And he laughed, and it was a joke, and that really, was the context of his joke. Anyway, when he went home, and when it went absolutely ballistic here, there was all sorts of stuff flowing. Ah, oh, he's having an affair, and his marriage is breaking down. All this kind of shit was all over the place. Just everything.
I'm just going to double down and say none of that true again to emphasise. This is the SHLT. Really make that clear. If you've just suddenly flicked on the radio, we're talking to.
There was
Paul
all
Kim
this speculation about this stuff.
All nonsense.
All nonsense.
True.
All nonsense. And I'm going to give you an example. Yeah. So, anyway. One of our editors pulled it out, splashed it across the masthead. My wife won't always be my wife, or may not always be my wife.
Yeah.
And when you read that in a context, it's really shocking.
Yeah.
It's absolutely shocking. Front page, and I saw this and I went absolutely crazy. I went crazy.
Yeah.
I called Aynon, I said, right, I am not working. I'm done here. I'm finished. I want an apology on the front page of the paper next week to Roy Keane. I want an apology for it. And until that apology goes in, I'm done here. Do what you like me. Send me home.
Mm-hmm.
I did not write until for the 7 days that followed that piece, until that apology was published in the front page of the paper to Roy Keane, an apology to Roy Keane. Now, if you can find that anywhere, in any newspaper, in the history of newspapers, I'll tip my cap to you because that wasn't done before. So when I meet Roy and he says, well, you know, you didn't, back me back inside. I said, okay, well, here you go. Have a look at that apology there, and you tell me how many journalists were going out and on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the point about that.
Mm. The last piece I read last night was the Joe Brawley with Padraig Heffron.
Yeah.
And then you tend to stay up for half an hour afterwards, almost angry on Heffron's behalf. I mean, I'd read the piece before because it's 2017. We've been doing the paper review for a while now. If people haven't read this piece, they really should. It's really horrific. On so many levels. Padraig Heffron joined the PSNI post the Good Friday Agreement. It was a new police service. He was a GAA man. And in short, he was shunned by his GAA club and the people in the GAA club. And then worse still, he gets into his car and a bomb goes off and blows his legs off. And Brawley is interviewed, and Brawley seems to know him. Going back the years, at one stage he says...
Yeah, he just got to know him, I think.
Oh, did he? Well, because at one stage he says he kissed one of my sisters at the Gael Talk, maybe both of them.
Yeah,
so I got the sense they've known each other from afar. Right, okay.
I think that might have been something that was a commonality between them in terms of he knew that he'd known his sisters in back in the day.
Yeah, it's an amazing interview. It's really amazing.
It's one of the most... Somebody said to me after it came out, I mean, obviously... In Northern Ireland, it in particular, it caused a huge reaction. And one of the people inside described it as one of the most important pieces published in any section of any newspaper in 2017 because it shone a light on something that we don't always like shining a light on, you know, the sort of prejudices that are there, still there.
Mm.
It's shocking to think that somebody could come through an entire club, and we all know about what we hear about clubs and how important your club is and the unity and community and stuff, and because he decides to join, you know, the recently formed PSNI, he's first of all shunned, and then later his life is ruined, and he doesn't sugarcoat it in any way, and it you know, towards the end of the piece he says he's a bitter man. It's a tough read. Joe didn't pull his punches in it.
No, he didn't. I mean, there's a phrase which in some respects, if you weren't interviewing him himself, you'd say was almost so crude it was unfair or disrespectful. He says his arse had been blown off, literally blown off. At that point it seems certain he would die. So he's in the car and it goes.
I remember we had a discussion over that sentence.
Did you?
We had to talk about it.
Yeah.
And you have to, you can't, like what we said earlier, like words have meaning and you can't just be idle about it. But it's such an important sentence in the context of the piece, as hard as it is to read. By the time you've got to the end of the piece, I think the piece justifies the strength of that sentence.
Yeah, he talks about the horror of trying to get out of the car. Why can't I feel my legs? Ambulance men arrived, they turned me over, then they had the OF moment.
And his wife was one of the first on the scene. She was a police officer as well.
They'd been married just 4 months. The treatment he got at the GA club while he was still playing was, training, and they're picking two teams and he's not picked, so he just kind of plays in the game anyway and runs around, and so the GAA club certainly don't come out of this well. On the field, his manager ignored him, a stubborn bee. He simply joined in with the teams. Funny, when the incident happened, he was visited by two members of the club, and they stressed to, I think it was his parents at the time, he was in a coma. My father, Frank, played for Craigan, and the club referee, treasurer, they said to him when they arrived, "We're not here on behalf of the club, only in a personal capacity." And then he says, and I'm sure this was legally tricky, he talks about being fairly certain guys he'd played with may have passed on details to others. People I knew, as in surrounding the bomb, people I knew well were arrested and questioned about the bomb. There were no prosecutions. And then he looks at Brolly. Excuse the language, but I think it's worth including in this context. If you have kids in the car, flick off now, maybe. And he goes on to say, "It's hard with pricks like you defending them." And Brolly says, as he says that, he raises the middle finger to me.
Yes, you know, there's the bitterness. And do you know, it's funny, the start of the piece is what really got me, because, you know, the very first words, "Get effed into them, lads, effed into them." And there's a couple of sentences which bring us a typical scene at a GAA match anywhere in the country. There's a guy shouting and there's a match playing and he's telling a lad to get stuck into another lad, and he does, and he cheers it and stuff. And then he peels the camera back and he widens the shot, and then, you know, he finishes off by saying, "Padraig Heffernan is a big, strong, robust man in his early 40s. He's in a wheelchair." You know, it's a powerful image that he creates, and he goes, and it's all through it. He does that, and some of the language and choices of words are tough.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a tough subject.
Well, you suspect they're in keeping with him as a personality, actually, so it almost feels apt, you know.
And sometimes, you know, and this is part of the writing, and it's part of, like, with Paul and others, and with Eamon and David Walsh and Damon Sweeney, these part of the writer's personality as well comes through.
Yeah. What's your life like is the final question. He says, "It's a life, but it's not my life." So there's not really a silver lining in that, bar the fact he survived. You know, it's just terrible.
There's no. Just as you say, just that he survived.
Yeah.
Does there have to be
a silver lining?
No.
No.
I mean, and that's the thing that comes through in some of the pieces, and then in others, there's hope, and in others, there's humour.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we try to do, and it's hard with something like this because it's a kind of a time capsule, is I tried nearly as much as possible not to interfere with the pieces. So they're all published underneath their original headlines. They're all published with the introduction as it appeared in the paper.
Could I, as a reader, I mean, what I would have done, I don't know where you made a decision on this, but I would have put a context to the pieces.
I was just about to say that. I've left them all in their original form. A couple of times I've had to use footnotes to explain a reference that I thought might be a little too obscure, but I've used the introductions of the pieces at the time, altered them slightly if I thought they were a little obscure.
Okay.
And I've just let the date, you know, by having the date of the piece at the start, that's the context. So maybe that is a good question for you as a reader.
Would you want them explained?
What two places? I think so.
I wrestled with that, and I remember, I think I asked you at the time, and you were very strong that I should do it.
Yeah.
And in the end, I decided not to, as usual,
you didn't listen to me.
Well, in cases where I was struggling, the phone is a very quick tool. But
there's that, and there's also there are a few footnotes, and the introduction does kind of paint, set the scene a little bit as well, I think.
Yeah. Any others you want to mention? I mean, there's 40
I was
of them.
There was one just while we were sitting outside, there was a passage that I read to Paul, because there is humour in it, there's some good laughs in it.
I've gone for all the...
There's a very good piece that Eamon Sweeney wrote a few years ago called Hurling Man, which is very funny. But on the day that's in it, after what we witnessed last night, there's a piece by Neil Francis in which he imagines his first day in hell, because he's saying that there's absolutely no doubt that that's where he's going as soon as the time comes. So being Neil Francis, he's whistled straight to a rugby match, and he describes what rugby is like in hell. And given what we saw last night, and given, you know, our sort of memories of the 80s and early 90s of what rugby used to be like, he's getting shown around hell, and then he's brought to his first rugby match, and the game has been described, and because it's not quite the same game that he was used to up here. So his guide is explaining, well, both teams are made up entirely of props, and the referee is a prop as well. We call our game crouch, touch, pause, engage, collapse. Mm. So the ball is kicked off, and because they're all props, they knock it on straight away and we have a scrum. They get down in the scrum and it collapses. They all get up again, shaking their heads and pointing at their opposite number. Then they get down for more scrums and more collapses. And Frano asks, but surely the ref gives a penalty. He does, but they are all props here and they don't know what to do, so they decline the penalty and opt for the scrum. Jesus, surely the ball comes out eventually. Don't say that word down here. And it goes on in that vein. And you know, if you close your eyes and you think of some of the rugby games that we watched in the late 80s and early 90s in the pourings of rain in the old Lansdowne Road, they seemed to have a bit of that shape to them.
Yeah. Anything you'd like to have included that you did or someone else did?
Being self-absorbed, I found the 96, because it was such a big thing for the newspaper to do in 96 at the Atlanta Olympics, you know, to take the stance that we took, to ask the questions that we did at a time when, for example, let's put it in this context. So we've had this incredible success last night in rugby, but yet I know something as a writer that, listen, this needs to be asked about this. There's a serious question about this team and how they've achieved this level of performance. Mm-hmm. So what editor nowadays would actually allow their journalist to do that? You know, given the cash that's flooding in from advertising and all that stuff into the media, and given the mood of the nation, and there's no doubt about it, and I'm part of that, it was great. Who's gone to just think now of an editor who will say, hold on a second, this is important, let's... And that was the greatest hat tip I can give to Angus Fanning and Eoin Ola Sullivan, was saying, right, those questions you're asking, they are very important, ask them, we'll back you. Mm. It was just astonishing that they would do that. It won't happen again, anywhere, ever again.
Do you not think so?
No.
Do you not think so?
No.
I think there's one piece in particular that you probably are thinking about, and... it's right on the cusp of the medals in 96, and it was published in the paper. And it's extraordinary that it went in so close to, you know, that it went in so close to the actual event. Mm-hmm. I mean, just in terms of the amount of, and I don't know because I wasn't there at the time, but I don't know what level of legal involvement there was at the time. But I mean, it is something that we carry with us all the time now. You know, putting the sponsors and you know, the fandom to one side for a second, there is plenty of serious journalism.
Absolutely.
There's plenty of serious journalism, and it's hampered in so many other ways. It's hampered by, you know, very draconian libel laws. It's hampered by a lack of resources to invest. To produce a story of depth and quality requires investment. And that's something that has been sucked out of the industry, and that's probably something that's... we're not going to see happening again.
I was just
going
to say, it's not likely to come back.
I don't... an example I've quoted before, and I mean, if you want to talk a bit more about it, but when Paul's, because he's here, when his 11,500-word interview with Rory McIlroy appeared in the paper over 2 weeks, was it? So what you're looking at there is over 2 weeks, you're looking at this interview that Paul has done with Rory McIlroy. What you don't see is the 18 months of planning and spending.
Stalking.
And stalking and hotel bills and plane bills are landing on my desk and going, oh Christ, you know, when, you know, you don't see that.
Sure.
But from the first moment, I think it was about 18 months, but I think, you know, every now and again with
it was,
Paul,
it was, yeah,
with everybody, but we'd sit down and we'd draw up a list of things that we need to do over the next 12 months. And obviously you're sitting down and you're drawing up a list of people that we'd love to talk to and have a good interview with, or a story that we need to pursue. And this is something we'd do all the time. And obviously Rory McIlroy is on top of that list at that time. So we sat in a room one day and we said, OK, how do we get to Planet Rory? And from there, I think it was a year and a half it took. Mm. Of investment on our part and hard work and doggedness on Paul's part. And that's true of any of the, you know, anybody who wants to produce the sort of stuff that we see in this book.
Yeah.
The sort of quality.
On the 7 days, name of the book, one last point to finish on, just to preempt people who might make the point, and you actually preempted in your introduction, is there's only four pieces by female journalists?
There's five pieces. Out of 48, out of 47, because there's five pieces by four female journalists.
Yeah, but it was interesting you were making the point, it's incredibly striking.
They weren't there.
Yeah.
When you go through the Cliona Foley was the only one really for, you know, and she's a piece with a very young
Katrina McKernan
in it. So it's only much later, when Marie Crowe, I think, was the kind of the first to come along for us. And then we've had Aisling Crowe and Claire McCormack since. But yes, and I have touched on it in the intro because it's a glaring thing. But yeah. I mean, when you're going through the archives, I can't rewrite history.
No, it was just an interesting observation. It's not a surprising one.
No, it's not. It wasn't a surprising one. In 30 years' time, if we're doing volume two, I'm sure the representation will be very different.
Yeah, I would have thought so. Listen, I'm sure a huge amount of work's gone into it, so the best of luck with it. On the 7th day, 30 years of great sports writing from the Sunday Independent is the book. John Green, Paul Kimmage, thanks very much, lads. We'll take a break.
Thanks, Joe.
Off the Ball on News Talk.